So I've been so excited for weeks to be able to talk to you about this book. And we do have some students. We have a number of online classes going on. We're currently in our summer, our first summer session here at Queen College of Philadelphia. And I know that for one of my colleagues in the English department, he is teaching the creative writing course for this first summer session. And so I thought that I would start with a question that would touch on the form, language, and process. And I watched the kickoff event, the conversation that we had with Terrence. And towards the end of that conversation, you had talked about, he had asked a question about the screenplay format and kind of what motivated you to choose the screenplay format for the novel. And you had mentioned something about the format allowed you to look at, enabled you to look at the writing in a less precious way, as well as economical. And so I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, like when you had said that it helped you to see the writing as less precious.
Sure, yeah. I think partly just in the discipline of TV writing, there's a lot more churn. You know, you can go, not to say that I wrote a lot of drafts of this book as well, but they, in terms of TV writing, you know, whole drafts can get tossed pretty quick, you know. And so I think for me, just psychologically, I guess, emotionally, there's less this kind of attachment to any particular form of that story. It feels like there's a lot of ways, you know, or you have to go through a lot of iterations to get to the right one. Whereas with fiction, it's the same thing, but I kind of lie to myself for longer. You know, I pretend that I'll see, and then 6 months later I'll let go of it. Whereas it's something, I guess, just looking at, you know, looking at a script format, I just have different associations with it. And so it's weird because I was writing a novel, but I was kind of tricking my brain into saying, stop thinking about like this as some serious literary novel. You know, that's honestly what caused me to take so long to write it in the first place. Because I kept thinking, you know, I need this book to mean something. I need this book to feel like to match the weight of the subject I need, which was my parents. It was based in a lot of ways on my parents' experience as immigrants to the U.S. And so I was kind of like carrying that burden for a long time. Oh, can I write, you know, a fancy, serious writer? Mm-hmm. And that sort of paralyzed. So anyway, switching to that format allowed me to just loosen up a little bit, basically. Mm-hmm.
I think that's really wonderful. And I think that's a great lesson for I'm sure that there are many people in the audience who see themselves as writers, and also for our students who are, you know, learning the craft of writing and so forth. And, you know, this whole process, because I think that so many of us see writing, like you were talking about, like having this personal connection to the writing, and then we feel like, oh, you know, I wrote this, this came from like somewhere deep in my soul, you know right. What I mean? And so that whole process of letting go, I think, you know, is really wonderful for you to share that as far as for yourself. I recall reading an interview where I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that I had read an interview where you also talked about, as far as like trying to be productive with writing this novel, that you kind of gave yourself certain time limits. So you were thinking about like the best time of day when you were productive, and then, you know, trying to accomplish, you know, a certain amount of writing in that time. And so it was that also to help you for writer's block, or I don't know if you could kind of speak to that maybe too for people who might feel like, oh, you know, sometimes I just don't know what to write. They're just like looking at their computer screen or their phone, sure, wherever it is that they're writing.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. I hate writing. Well, that's why I'm a writer. It's an extremely painful process to me. I'm not with people's system. I don't know people like that. And if I did, I would want to be friends with them. If they don't, but if I do games, don't talk to me where that kind of person. I did the math. People might have heard me say this before, but if you haven't, this might be helpful to someone. I did the math after I finished the book. And if I had written about 19 and a half words per day, I would have finished the same amount of time that it took me to write the book. Most of my productive time, honestly, was like getting in and out of the car, putting a child to sleep. And like a thought would occur, and that's the idea. And then I would sit down and go, oh, now I have to have a bunch of ideas related to this idea. But none of them were as good as the first idea. So productivity, sure. And I do think there's something that you said for like, sit down, put your butt in the chair, because you are doing certain things, I think subconsciously, I am, or subconsciously by organizing time, creating a space for your subconscious to start to work on the material. But what I ultimately find is it's not a process that I'm really actually very much in control of. What I'm doing is stumbling over different blocks, slowly figuring out, okay, next time go around that, you know, and setting up spaces where hopefully things can start to fill in, you know, with feeling, with experience, with memory. And so, yeah, I do find generally I'm more productive in the morning. I do find that the first hour, I probably 95% of what I'm going to get done, I probably already had it the first hour, and then just sharply drops off that. You know, there are the occasional times when late at night or right on a deadline, like nothing like a deadline to like force creativity out, but that's not usually the best way for me to kind of land something that's tricky.
I really love hearing writers talk about their process and also their relationship with what it is that they're writing. And I was recently watching a video recording of Neil Gaiman, and someone had asked him a question. Did he believe in what he wrote? Did he believe in the things that he wrote? And his response to that was, the reason why he writes fiction is because all the quote unquote lies that he tells is a way to get at the truth. And I'm wondering if you saw yourself when you were writing this, if you considered that in a similar kind of way as far as how the story was unfolding for you, like you're talking about like some of it was coming out of your subconscious, and you're also talking about, you know, this is kind of like the foundation just from the story of your parents and your parents' experiences as immigrants in the United States. And so I'm wondering if you ever thought about writing fiction in that way.
I think that's just, that's a great quote, you know, from Neil Gaiman. That's it resonates with me on a couple levels. I think when I, for instance, like I had a bunch of things that my parents told me over the years growing up, and those were kind of the kernel of this book. It's 50, 60, 70 pages that I just had for a long time, and I didn't know how to turn them into a novel. I don't know why I thought I wanted to turn them into a novel, but I think it's related to what you asked, Michelle. I think it's like, why not just publish that as a couple of essays, or why not build that into a memoir or biography of my parents, you know, and write nonfiction. And it, I think, comes from some impulse of wanting it to, I think two things, wanting to go deeper into it and unlock something that's in their stories that just a kind of bare recitation of their stories wouldn't necessarily, you know, bring it to the surface. And then the other kind of thing is, I think there's something about, yeah, the freedom that comes from fiction that really goes to what I was talking about is, you can both be more honest and hide behind fiction of it all. And so that's what I was looking for, is this kind of voice that I heard that, you know, when I finally did figure out what to do with the pages, it was because it became this synthesis of like this, the kernel of my parents' experiences, my own experiences informing that, then this fictional narrator, Willis Wu, and him becoming the kind of you know, channel or voice through which all of that could flow. And so that, without that, I guess, magical thing that happens, you know, between autobiography and fiction, then I think there's a whole bunch of it that I just never would have gotten through, mostly because, you know, like, my parents would have killed me if I thought about, you know, without changing all the names and stuff. No, I think it's like, it becomes hopefully both more specific and more universal.
And I think that I read that you talked about that idea of it being more specific, but at the same time also more universal in its specificity as you trying to capture these small moments. And there are so many of those in the novel. Like even before we were, you know, I was preparing for tonight's conversation, and there are so many scenes that I kept going back to, but there the one scene with, you know, Willis and his mother, and, you know, she's waiting for him. He's going up to the 8th floor to his room. And, you know, he skipped there for, because he was like, oh, you know, I don't know if I'm going to, you know, talk to mom, say, you know, I'm going to feel this heavy guilt and so forth. But she was already waiting for him. And then he saw the scar, you know, on her wrist. And then a couple of pages later, we learned how she got that scar. She got that scar when he was, you know, being a hungry kid, you know. And she, you know, tried to save the, you know, he had kicked the teapot. And so, you know, she caught it. And I'm just wondering if, you know, if in capturing those kind of, and also the things that he's noticing about his father, as his father is aging, like, you know, capturing those, I think you had talked about this in another movie, like these small moments, right?
Yeah, that's like for me where the gears like started to, you know, turn is after all of like looking for big concepts or like clever devices through which to tell a story, it was actually the really intimate moments between Willis and his mother, Willis and his father, and, you know, the two passages you're describing, Michelle, are, you know, really through the eyes of a you know, first a young child with his mom, and then kind of a double filter, like the son now looking at his father as someone that he now realizes he's got to take care of, like the sort of like polarity of the relationship is turning from, you know, the parent-child thing is reversing. And, you know, how Willis navigates that is kind of an understanding that he gained from his father, which is to pay close attention to the invisible dynamics between people. And that's something that Willis's dad did when he came to the U.S. was extremely polite and tactful as a kind of strategy for survival. He learned the rules, you know, the unspoken rules. He learned etiquette. He made sure that never offended people and fit into this kind of stereotype of a quiet, you know, compliant, law-abiding immigrant from Asia. And in that he embodied a whole bunch of things that Willis kind of himself internalized. And now as Willis grows up, he is looking at his dad. And sure, there are not so great things about having learned all of that from his dad, but one thing he also learned was how to preserve the integrity of the social situation, you know, which is also called tact, you know, how to preserve his father's dignity as his dad ages and can't be himself. And so that passage involves Willis performing as a son. Basically, he's trying to perfectly portray a son who his dad remembers and who can give his dad face, basically, who can preserve the relationship between father and son, even while Willis is actually starting to take care of his dad. So it was in figuring out that kind of performance of a son for an aging father is a role that people play that I realized, oh, that's the conceit that I'm actually interested in writing about. You know, sure, there's Kung Fu Guy and Channel Vision, those are roles, but through the smallest thing is actually where the book kind of unlocked itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, when I first started to read this, and you know, you started to get past, like, you know, the structure of the book, the different roles, right, for the listing of the roles for him, right, and listing of the roles for his father, listing of the roles for his mother, and then you start getting into, like, the setting of the scene, and you start getting into the interiority, right? You can definitely, you know, quickly here at time, like, really unpack the metaphor of the interiority of this book, because there's so many levels of interiority. But, you know, by page 15, I was crying, you know, and, you know, and I had to kind of pause, because when the narrative started to get into those small moments. And I think that for me, as someone who identifies as being Asian American, as being a child of an immigrant, right, and seeing, you know, just like exactly the thing that you were talking about, like understanding, you know, how the roles become reversed, you know, and we can see like our parents becoming older and so forth, and we know the struggle that they've gone through, we know their story. And I think that for me, especially coming out of the pandemic and the way in which our elders, like in the Asian American community, you know, this has been rendered so vulnerable, right, in so many ways with the anti-Asian violence. And then to humanize, right, Willis's father like that, and then also, you know, his mother, like going right from that relationship into the relationship with the mother, and him having that conversation with his mother where she's like, he needs help, you know, moving the bed. And he's like, you need my help or whatever. And then he stops and realizes that she wouldn't be saying these things to me if it was okay, you know? And so I'm just, you know, wondering as far as people's reaction, especially in regards to the representation of Asian American elders. And you bring it back around to that at the end of the book too, you know what I mean? With the dismantling and going to Chinatown exterior, right? You know, has there been a different kind of response to the way that our elder generation is being represented to your book that people are kind of expressing to you that maybe they hadn't prior to the pandemic and the anti-Asian?
That's interesting. On some level, I have felt a little bit of a shift, but I don't have that much data because actually the book came out right at the beginning of the pandemic. So I was, you know, I was back in New York doing a little mini tour and did a couple of events on the West Coast, and then everything shut down. So and then you're doing Zoom events for a while, and then at the same time, so this incredible, awful rise of anti-Asian sentiment and attacks is occurring. So really only I know, like the book sort of only kind of exists in the after of that. I do think, yeah, it's obviously in some of I did not predict any of that. What it felt to me was that the book talked about the vulnerability and I guess on some level the lack of subjectivity for older Asian people in the US and how they generally haven't been portrayed with a whole lot of nuance in US TV and film until very recently, and what that could do, right? What does that do to them? What does that do to their offspring? And what does this do to the perceptions of other people who are not in that group as sort of outsiders who, you know, may or may not have empathy for them naturally, but what does it do to a group of people when you just don't get to see them portrayed fictionally, you know, in our mass media? And sadly, it in a lot of ways just confirmed this kind of deep anxiety that I always had, which was that people don't generally, you know, it turns out that there was a kind of empathy gap or like lack of understanding of people, and that can contribute to these incredibly horrible things that we were seeing, which is older Asian people being attacked in a way you just generally don't see older people being attacked. I mean, not to racialize it, it's awful if anyone's attacked, especially an older person, but especially a physically vulnerable person, I guess. But I think there just was some element of it that just felt particularly like connected to the fact that, you know, because it's maybe language or accent or culture or just physical traits, there seemed to be some lack of humanity ascribed to people, and that could somehow make them more likely to be attacked. And that just was a really hard, I mean, it's just a, almost like unwatchable thing to like kind of try to process. And so, again, I have no particular insight into it other than I watched it along with everyone else probably and was just like horrified by it. And, you know, the fact that the book exists and there are these older Asian characters in there does allow the I guess there's a silver lining, allow for conversations like this one for us to, you know, talk about a book, my book, but talk about other books that are better than this book, you know, but talk about the need for more characters and portrayals.
So I really would love to continue to unpack this, you know, the representation of invisibility or the way the book treats invisibility and marginalization and vulnerability and so forth. And, you know, I teach Asian American studies, and one of the books that I use is Helen Zia's Asian American Dreams. And to start chapter two in that book, she, you know, talks about when she's talking about how when she thinks back to her education in the United States, growing up in the United States, right, and learning U.S. history, that anytime that, you know, Asian people were represented in her learning of U.S. history, it seemed though the representations either were, you know, Asians were reviled or rendered invisible. And, you know, of course, you know, there's so many elements of invisibility in your book. And as I was reading it, I was also thinking about something that one of my students who self-identifies as Asian American said to me earlier this spring. And what she said to me was, my generation doesn't speak up because we're afraid that we won't be heard. And so I'm wondering, you know, do you see a difference between like visible invisibility and visible dismissibility? Like, are those two things like different? I'm not sure if you understand like what it is I'm trying to say. Like, you know, people who are visible but are not seen versus someone who is seen but is just dismissed. And so for me in this book, you know, the way that Willis looks out at the world and the way that he perceives that the world perceives him, you know, I felt as though he was seeing himself, you know, he's seen, but he's seen in a way that's dismissed. So he's not completely invisible. He's just dismissed, which in many ways is, you know, we can talk about whether or not that's more invalidating or whatever, but kind of leads to, you know, some of the, at least the way that I was looking at it, you know, some of the originally out of a certain situation. So I'm just curious, like, what you think.
Yeah, I was getting really nervous to hear the question because it sounded like an essay song. You kind of answered the question, so thanks for that. I do think there's a difference. You know, I think you framed it really well. And I think it's probably closer to B, which is the kind of obviously people can physically see Willis, you know, but what does it feel like to not register, you know, to not be? The way I think about it is that somehow, though, what happens, what's weird about like film and TV representation is that that dismissibility that you're talking about turns into literal invisibility in the casting process. You know, like for a long time, there were no very, very few Asians on, you know, like major TV shows and movies, right? And like just to use one example, like I would, you know, watching a medical show, you're like, there's no Indian people in this hospital. There's no Filipino people in this hospital. Like, where are these Asians in this hospital? And Another example, not to call out Marvel because I do work for Disney, but I remember watching Iron Man 2, one of the Iron Mans, and I think you know, Robert Downey Jr.'s character is at an MIT class reunion, and I have never seen a more egregious racial breakdown of background actors than at the MIT class reunion, which had no Asians in. I mean, you could count that background. It was insane. How did that happen? That was like probably 10, 15 years ago. Not even that. There's just a magical filtering thing that turns Asians literally invisible for a long time, for decades. And so that's really what the book is about. I think that dismissibility, to me, like becomes literal and then has this very powerful distortion effect on reality. Because obviously we go out into the, you know, especially in one big city, see Asians, but somehow you don't see them, you know, in these stories that we tell about what America looks like. So that's kind of what I was interested in, that the interaction between those two things.
And as we get into Act 6, right, cases in the Asian, were those some of the things that you wanted to explore a little bit more, right, this process of invisibility? And then, you know, through the case, through the trial, right, bringing up certain things to, you know, kind of remind the audience, or educate the audience if the audience isn't aware of, like, all of these ways in which, you know, there has maybe, you know, for many of us who identify as Asian American, we do see it as like a systematic erasure of our presence in the United States. And so I'm just wondering, like, from everything that you just spoke about, was that partly like what you're trying to do in that?
Yeah, I think so. And I think part of also the last act is, and I think the book as a whole, is that it's not as much, it's not meant to be just like an indictment of casting process, you know, in the US or of big media companies. I think there's lots of blame to assign there, but those are, you know, decisions made by businesses and based on audience, you know, demand, I guess, is the theory. So there's that. But I think a big part of it is also Willis himself and how he's internalized all of this. And that, I don't want to say complicity, but I think it's some level of accountability for himself to say, I have agency. I'm growing up in a free country, a place where my parents immigrated that has given them a lot of opportunity. And I am finding myself, you know, to be limited by things in my own psychological makeup. So it's Willis, the last part is really meant to be kind of a trial for Willis to say, okay, you can point at systemic, you know, bias or invisibility that you didn't choose, but also, you know, what are you going to do about it? And how much of it is internalized racism? Not to victim blame, you know, Willis for internalizing discrimination, but it's the grappling with that. It's less about some kind of struggle against external forces and more about like his coming of age and maturity, I guess. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as far as his perception of these external forces and the structures, is that also partly why you have the second person, why you're using the second person? I know that a lot of people like to talk about the use of second person in the novel. I think for me, the way that I looked at it was, you know, him, you know, trying to understand the reality around him, and it's kind of his self-talk, you know what I mean? And then these structures that he's been conditioned to kind of see around him, maybe from watching television, right? When he saw himself as a kung fu kid, you know? So I was wondering, you know, and then he reclaims his voice at the end, like through that monologue, you know? And then there's the breaking of the form. There are a number of places, obviously, in the book where you break the form. But I'm just wondering if, you know, if that's, you know, what you were thinking of, like with the monologue, like him reclaiming his voice.
Yeah, I think so. I think, yeah, second person was the most visceral and immediate thing. I did try first person, I tried third person, even thought right. second person was kind of a bit of a sling. I was really nervous for a long time to, like, I resisted it, but it, I knew that it was actually where, like, the book just really started to flow when, once I started writing the second person. So I think it's, you know, a lot of what you're talking about, and it's a lot about inserting the reader in the most direct way possible into Willis's head, you know. So that's what I wanted to do, was give, you know, subjectivity to this guy and put people, you know, in the shoes of the generic human.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting. Also, going back to the comment that she made a few moments ago about accountability, because in some of those moments where the form breaks out of the screenplay, it's other people kind of saying, "Hey, pick up," right? So you know, we see the one part where he's, you know, where he breaks form, and it's just so, I just really love how you have, like, written literally in the margins, and then when he decided to speak up, like, to actually be on the, you know, the police show, on the black and white police show, and then he came into, right, actually into a speaking role. And then also, like, later, there's a conversation between me and Karen where she's, you know, it's in the screenplay format, and then she's like, "Why are we talking about this?" And he's like, "Oh yeah, you know, sometimes I kind of forget." And it goes into, you know, prose, right? And then also at the very end, you know, after the trial, you know, where, you know, they've declared him dead, and then Turner comes up to him, and then he says, "Well, off script," right? Mm-hmm. And then he goes back into the prose part, you know what I mean? So there are these moments where sometimes, you know, it's him trying to assert himself, but then it's also like when characters are saying to him, you know, they go off script because they're like, why are you in this structure? You know what I mean? And then he's kind of like catching himself. He becomes more self-aware and he's like, "Oh yeah, why am I talking like this?"
Right, yeah. Yeah, I think the dancing or sort of like jumping around between the worlds, like breaking rules or complying with them, which is sort of that ability to jump in and out of the script was the most, it was the reason why the script format had to be the way I wrote it. Because that there's sort of no, it's the most clear device to the reader visually, and then conceptually, most people, you know, can understand the script. Even if you haven't read one, read a play, same thing. So, like, the ability to, even down to the level of, like, well, not down to the level, but even on the level of, like, visual, like, text on the page, just that one, I think that jumping in and out was much, what made, well, I couldn't have done it, but I just had to step to kind of the, if I had to stick to just blocks of prose, I don't really know how I would have done it, actually. And then it also just made it sort of more fun, you know, to write.
I wanted to ask you some questions about the interaction between Willis and Miles Turner, since, you know, in that last question I kind of brought him up, because I think there's, you know, there are so many interesting dynamics, right, that are brought up between he and, you know, him and the two police officers, you know, with the whole black and white show and so forth. But there's the one piece of dialogue at the end where you know, Miles says to Willis, "Oh, they, you know, they used you, they pitted you against us," right? That part of that whole accountability thing. And I'm just wondering if, in terms of talking about, you know, these other complex racial dynamics going on with Willis and trying to figure out his place in the world, especially in relationship to other communities of color. I'm just wondering, like, how you saw the progression of their particular relationship between Willis and Mike.
Yeah, I guess the progression, I don't know if this actually tracks with what's in the book, but in my head, the progression of the writing of the character was that the idea of, like, Willis as a kid wanting to be cool, an American kid, would have had lots of role models that were white and lots of role models that were black, and probably zero to one role model that was Asian, which is pretty good. So I think that's where the idea of, you know, Miles Turner as, like, a kind of very stereotypical, but also the very kind of like commercially viable, cool action hero came from. And so then I was thinking, well, of course, there's many books on that, the relationship between an Asian kid wanting to, you know, pattern himself after a cool black role model, you know. And I thought, one, I'm not qualified to write that book. And two, this book could easily, like, the gravity of that just pull everything towards that. So I had to make a decision to, like, ignore Turner in some way to really minimize it so that he exists as a kind of idea in Lewis's head. And get the idea and get, like, even model of masculinity, of coolness, but he's also sort of trapped as much as Willis is, stereotype. You know, he's supposed to be just cool leading man guy. And that doesn't sound as bad as generic Asian man or dead Asian guy, but it's, you know, I guess what the book's trying to do is explore how limited he is in a way. And, you know, kind of like brush up against, like, Willis brushes up against Turner and his story and his reality, but it's more of a nod and a kind of acknowledgement rather than a full, like, relationship. So I think that was really what I wanted to do, is set up the idea of Turner exists in the world, Willis is aware of him, he has a certain cultural pull on Willis, but ultimately Willis has to kind of navigate on his own, in his own way.
Yeah, I mean, I think as I was reading it, like, I definitely saw the admiration. You could feel the admiration, but also that feeling of competitiveness, mm-hmm. right, with Miles. But I so appreciated that at the end of the book, you know, when Willis finally goes off script, you know, it's Miles, you know, who's kind of like, you know, helping him transition into that moment in the last couple of pages. And I'm also thinking about this in relationship to the way in which you brought up, like, again, like, as far as the perception of, you know, Asian Americans by and large in the United States, like bringing up terms like model minority, right, and perpetual foreigner. And when Miles, you know, it's at that point in the trial where he says, you know, they used you, right, and used you to pit us against each other and so forth and so on. So that, I guess, you know, the idea is that we wouldn't understand, like, you know, who was really, you know, trying to control us, or who was trying to oppress us. And I thought that was so interesting, given that, you know, in terms of that term, model minority, was, you know, was basically constructed, was created by a white sociologist, and was done so in a way in the 1960s to say to Black people, oh, you should be more like the Asians, you know, right. Because and so forth and so on. And so I'm wondering if, you know, that was also like an element that you were thinking about in terms of, like, having, you know, Miles saying this, you know, making those statements to Willis.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, the history of Asians in America, even before that, but that construction of the model minority concept and myth. And then before that, going back to, like, Asian and Chinese, like, railroad workers and other laborers being sort of scapegoated, and the resentments of working class white workers, you know, from 50 years ago, the kind of, so in that sense, it would have been class, I guess, more than race, I think that, but the idea of Asians having kind of this long history of being used as a wedge or a scapegoat. And that was, you know, part of Willis's education. The second half of the book is he's going through kind of personal education, he's coming of age. And then the second half, the author speaks in some, like, legal history. I had to get the veggies in. Yeah. You know, like, you thought you were reading this Philly book in manuscript form, but Asian American studies in here.
No, which I loved. You know, I love that all of those veggies were in there. Because you had mentioned, like, you know, role models and so forth, and that Willis growing up wouldn't have had many Asian role models or Asian American role models other than Bruce Lee. So I just kind of wanted to kind of touch on that. I think that, you know, as I was reading this, I was thinking, because I teach Bruce Lee in my Asian American studies, so that's because I think that my students should know who Bruce Lee was. And, but what I find is that many, young Asian Americans only have a very vague idea of Bruce Lee, and then they become really fascinated, right? Because, they know him as a martial artist, and they knew that he was an icon, but they, didn't grow up with that perception of him, and as someone that is for Asian Americans, is like, this is someone who's the closest thing to a hero, mm-hmm. as you would have, but then also to learn about his philosophy, mm-hmm. right, and everything behind his martial arts form that he created and so forth. And so I'm just wondering, like, for you in writing that, like, from Kung Fu Kid to, Kung Fu Guy to Kung Fu Dad, right? The importance of having that element of Bruce Lee in this book as being that iconic hero that's like for our generation, right? Yep. Who grew up watching Bruce Lee, why that was so important for you.
Yeah, I mean, for people that maybe won't know this already, but maybe others won't, in terms of age, because I have two teenagers at home, my wife and I have two teenagers, and I don't think they can't really understand what it's like. I mean, they are lucky enough to grow up in a world where there's plenty of cool Asians to look up to, and that's great. It's amazing. So I don't think I grew up in the 80s and 90s, it was like Bruce Lee was he was like Superman, and I don't know, I'm trying to think of other things, like Superman and I don't know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and he was Albert Einstein. He was all of it, because he was a kind of, like, he had a philosophy, he had a worldview, he had an intensity to him. He had, obviously, was a physical genius, but he embodied so many things. And then on top of all that, like, he was actually cool, like, he was any kid on the block with no doubting how cool, like, you just look at him, he's as cool as a superhero, if not cooler, like a video game character come to life. And so that unassailable coolness was very valuable as a kid, because I was not cool, very far from being cool. And not only that, but I felt I wasn't just like, because, if I'd just been like, say, a white kid who was not cool, that's different, because it seems possible you could be cool someday. I was uncool being an Asian kid, I think at that time, it didn't seem possible that any Asians could be cool. My parents, my cousins, my friends, my family friends, like, none of us were ever going to be cool. I didn't know any cool people. Except for him, like, he made it possible. So he moved the impossible into possibility. And so that gave me hope.
Do you think by the end of the book, Willis sees to be as cool?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's how I feel about my own kids. They are cooler than I could have ever hoped to be. And I love that. And they also see me as deeply uncool, obviously. I'm
very okay with it. Yeah, I mean, I think that for him, like, to make that choice, like, again, going to agency and him kind of reclaiming his identity and saying, I'm just that, right? Mm-hmm. I'm just that, And seeing, you see that the shift there, right? Where it's maybe, it's not Bruce Lee, right? Or being Kung Fu Guy, or maybe it's not someone like a Miles Turner or whatever. It's his daughter and his child, the role model of the hero, right? Yeah. And it's such a beautiful thing. And I know that we're setting up because we're going to start getting questions from the audience, but I think the last question that I'd like to ask you, so here in Philadelphia, as far as our own Chinatown, we have a very long proud history, right, of activism. Like, right now, we're, many organizations and even student organizations around the city are fighting against the proposal of a sister Rowena, like, you know, near Chinatown. So we have a very long and proud history. And I'm just wondering, like, you know, for you, in terms of, you know, calling this interior Chinatown, like, ultimately, as far as like people who are, you know, quote unquote, like outsiders to Chinatown, who go into Chinatown as like a tourist in you know, in many different kind of ways. Like, what was there like a hope for you as far as like what you're hoping that people will now see in regards to Chinatown and the people, you know, the history of Chinatown, the people who have lived in Chinatown and so forth? Was there like an ultimate hope for you?
Yeah, I think so. I think you framed it well. There's so, a lot to unpack in that. I'm trying to ramble on, but I think just to get at the heart of it, it is, again, telling the story and stories of people that normally don't get that speak as protagonists and haven't historically. And people living in SRO, people, you know, who have been here for over, you know, for generations, you know, and who are part of America, who are part of the American experiment. And that the what that says and does to the conception of America, you know, racially as a place of like, you know, beyond sort of black white sort of dynamic, beyond the sort of duality of that, that it's, it has long been for a couple hundred years, a multiracial, not just biracial country. And that, yes, there's of course, you know, the original staining and sin of slavery, and of course, even before that, of indigenous peoples, and that there's another invisible history that generally hasn't been taught too much in primary schools anyway, and how that is, again, all part of the fabric and sort of history of this country. And so, not that this book can do that, but that in some small way to just be part of that conversation, seeking some of those stories.
Well, thank you. So grateful for you for doing all of that and for having that aspiration for the story that you're writing in this book. And I think at this time, we want to now go to the audience and get any questions that any of you may have. We have microphones set up in either aisle here. So please feel free to, you know, start coming up to the microphone to ask Shelley a question.
With the name you, I could digress and ask you if that had anything to do with the moon fish and its original content, but no. When you said about the protagonist, you, and I thought, you're not going to get away with that more than a couple of times. <You're out. laughs> That's clever. Yeah, that's a very good device because you used it well. Pretty happy across that bridge. Now, when you first told me it was me, then it reminded me of John Lennon's I am he, you are he, and you are me, and we are all together. I wondered if that ever went through your mind as you produced that.
Thank you. My last name does not have anything to do with fish shortening. It is the yo, actually, yo. So it's women.
Okay.
In Mandarin. And so, and I didn't think of the John Lennon lyric. I think that I do think the fluidity of what you're talking about, though, is what got me interested in second person, is that you can use it to that effect. And so that would be other dimension, I think. Besides like inserting the reader into Willis's head, also you tends to be, you know, sometimes it's internal monologue and sometimes it's a little preachy and sometimes it's Willis, you know, having a kind of bifurcated self. So it did a bunch of things that were then. No, thank you. I think I've got a good question. Tell me if I missed any of it. I feel an affinity, and some of it is kind of a mystery to me, but I do feel, I mean, I still have a lot of family from Taiwan. My parents are from Taiwan, and family from Taiwan that immigrated here. So there's cultural and other kind of affinity for sure. And also still just, I guess, maybe some kind of like tie. I don't know where the, within our hearts, our souls, our genes, I don't know. But something like that's, I guess that's the place that, you know, my parents are from and further back than that. I am also, yeah, I was born and raised in the U.S. This is the only country I've ever lived in. I definitely very American. And that's really all I am, you know. I'm not bicultural, really, even honestly. Like, I think that's the weird, and so that, to me, gives rise to a weird, like, disjunct between how I feel on the inside and what I look like on the outside. And that's kind of part of the interior of this book as well, is what it's like to be a kid looking in a mirror. That's my face. This is me, you know, and that's a particular way of growing up, you know, that's a particular way of, you know, that's going to inform psychology and all kinds of things. So I don't know if that answers your question. I think, you know, there's a lot of people, my generation, a lot of people, you know, of different generations that have similar or not so similar experiences, but have probably a whole variety of, you know, differences and sort of their, I don't know how close they feel to their ethnic heritage or community, but that's my own flavor of it.
I would like to say thank you. My question is a little bit along the lines of some questions that you and some of the author about Chinatown and the journey of the character was in part a journey of freeing himself from Chinatown, and I just would love to hear your thoughts and maybe ambivalence about the existence of Chinatown.
Sure. Yeah, that's I'm not an expert. I wouldn't say that, and I don't know. I think the Chinatown in this book is not a real Chinatown. It is kind of an amalgam. It's a fictional place. But it's an amalgam of features or things that I learned and researched about various U.S. Chinatowns. Chinatown, as many people know, is in, you know, kind of a way station or a safe haven or home for many people for generations. There's, you know, my wife's family is like that, and like they have people in their family where they basically live within a 10, maybe even smaller 10 block radius, you know, for generations. Don't really leave home in that sense, say within this enclave, see their, you know, whatever dialect they speak and shop and live amongst people that are basically from their ethnic community. And that came about originally as a kind of necessity, you know, like, and you were excluded in all kinds of ways, legally from black property, intermarrying, all kinds of things. And so the fact that they persist and then have taken in new waves of immigrants, some Chinese, some from other Asian countries, this kind of an evolution that's still happening, as far as I understand, in Chinatown. So to me, it's not so much ambivalence as it's like a rich and vital part of an immigrant experience, in a particular subset of immigrant experiences. I think the Chinatown in this book is a mental state. You know, it's a state that Willis wants to break out of, which is the idea that he's limited to being Asian guy. You know, it's the idea that for many years, I felt that way too, that if I walked into a room, I wasn't X or Y or Z, I was just an Asian guy, you know, my friend group and at work. And so I think that's where the ambivalence that I think you're alluding to comes from, is that Willis is struggling with that he is identified sort of in this monolithic way, basically. Thank you. Yeah, that's such a good question. It came about in the writing because I think there was a sense in which these characters didn't matter to the story, right? So they could literally just be killed off in this fictional way and brought back and no one really noticed because they're not protagonists. They're just nameless, faceless background people. So that was the symbolic genesis of it. I think the thing that made it kind of work for me anyway, emotionally on a deeper level was all of the tiny emotional deaths that I think a lot of immigrants and, you know, invisible people have to face on a daily basis. So, you know, instead of heroes who constantly are on this kind of upward trajectory, or even in the defeats, they have a kind of glamour to them. You know, the characters in this book, especially with his parents, I think, don't have that glamour. You know, they're constantly, and I saw this with my own parents' experience, constantly facing little humiliations, you know, constantly being humbled or reminded of their, you know, outsider status or their inadequacy, you know, in so many ways. So, and there were, you know, specific things that I remember as a kid kind of watching my parents go through that felt like a little kind of death that you had to kind of shake yourself, you know, you had to just swallow it. And then they didn't. I didn't eat it, honestly. I have much more privilege than my parents, so thanks to them. And so they experienced it over and over again in small ways.
Thank you so much for your question.